to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.
Hello there. You know, there are so many Christian women with fascinating stories. In fact, I am sure that your story is fascinating. But these women that we talk about, some are missionaries, some are musicians, some are reformers, authors, teachers, some are wives, some are single, some are mothers. But their stories are examples and inspirational to all of us. So this is Cheryl Broderson. My co-host Robin is not here today, and I am sad about that. She was so sad that she couldn't be here today. But I do have in studio a friend and someone I am so excited about, because she and I are going to talk about, especially her, I'm going to just ask questions about one of my favorite authors. So this is like a twofer. Like, it's very, very exciting. So I have Dr. Amy Orr Ewing. And the interesting thing is, Amy, I knew you, but I had no idea that you did your doctoral thesis on, here it comes, drum roll, Dorothy Sayers.
Absolutely. Hi, Cheryl.
Oh, my goodness. Like, I read all of the Peter Wimsey books, mm-hmm. As a child, high school.
Yeah.
And then you read them again in your 20s and your 30s, because they're fascinating mysteries. I love mysteries. I love that genre. And that was something that England kind of capitalized on. And then I began to discover her theological works, like Letters to a Diminished Church.
Mm.
One of my all-time favorites are Women Human.
Yes.
So, so good.
Very good.
Yeah. And her plays. Also,
yeah.
The Mind yes. of God. Yes.
Mind of the Maker.
The Mind of the Maker. That's it.
And then the play cycle, The Man Born to Be King.
That's it. Yeah. Yes. So it was, I had no idea of this Christian heritage that Dorothy had till I was probably in my 50s.
Wow.
And I began to, I somehow picked up a biography, that strange woman at a thrift store. In England.
Yes.
That's like, what? But later I learned that's not an authorized biography. So I'm going to start out, why did you choose Dorothy Sayers?
Sure. So thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's like so exciting.
Always a joy to be here. So I had worked in the field of Christian apologetics and public theology for quite a while, maybe 15 years. And hugely influential figure in that scene is C.S. Lewis, who That's we right. all love. You know, all
yes.
Christians seemingly love Lewis. And one of Lewis's dearest friends, and the only kind of woman who was regarded as being really in that circle, was Dorothy L. Sayers, who obviously, as you've already said, was a writer of detective fiction, but during and after the Second World War really emerged as one of the leading Christian thinkers and speakers in the UK. And I became interested in, you know, how she presented Christ through the different genres that she used. I mean, she had huge public and popular appeal. Actually, after university, she was one of the first women, she was in the first cohort of women to be allowed to graduate from Oxford with a degree. So women used to be able to audit the courses, but she actually had a degree conferred on her.
Wasn't that 2 years after she graduated? Though?
Yes, she'd already finished the course
right.
of study, and, you know, she was in that first class. She was high, you know, very high level, but she was in the first cohort that they actually awarded the honours degree to. And after that, she went to work in an advertising agency, and she came up with the phrase, "It pays to advertise," and all sorts of other creative ideas in advertising.
So we call those jingles.
Yeah,
here exactly. I don't know if you call them jingles in England.
And she
or
had
not.
A real kind of skill for that, for public communication, and yet this extraordinary depth as well. And so I realized that as I kind of looked into her more, I realized that while Lewis, after his death, was increasingly read by Christians, Sayers really wasn't. And while he had, you know, maybe 150 biographies of his life, she had less than 10. Whereas actually in their lifetime, she was seen as at least his equal in terms of impact. And that was interesting to me. And I wanted to really dig into what kind of drove her work, what held her work together, what did the Lord really use in what she did uniquely that we could learn from today.
So what places did your research take you?
Ah, well, physical places. Yes. One of them is the Wade Center at Wheaton, where they have the major collection of her writings, and actually C.S. Lewis's writings are all held there. And so there's over 50,000 letters that she wrote.
No.
So, yeah, that the research meant reading everything she'd written. Mm-hmm. So not just her published works, but all.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah, so her handwriting I got to know very well. And then I went to her hometown, and there was a small sort of archive of material there. And then just a lot of study at Oxford as well. The libraries there are really amazing. So physically, that's where it took me. And then like the scope of the research was beginning reading her. So Alistair McGrath said to me, do you, the best way to approach this, because it feels like an overwhelming task,
right,
just to read it.
Right.
So the best thing to do is read everything she wrote in the order she wrote it. So as you read her 50,000 letters, read the letters that she's writing at the same time that she's writing that particular detective novel or that particular essay. So you're getting a sense of what's happening with the whole person. And that
Excellent.
Was just such a brilliant piece of advice.
Excellent. Oh, yeah. My goodness. I love that, because also, too, you've got the context.
Yeah,
of when
exactly.
she's writing too, because the yeah. letter sets the time.
Yeah, you know, and like, often she initially developed thoughts. So the thoughts that she developed in her book, The Mind of the Maker, which is a kind of book really about the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity, but she looks at it through the lens of human creativity in the process of writing a book as an author, and shows how the Trinitarian God is actually reflected in our own human creative reality. But while she was coming up with those ideas, she'd actually written a play that explored some of that. And then she had an extended correspondence of letters with a clergyman who asked her a lot of questions that enabled her to really, yeah, develop
clarify
those ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So, now that we have this, let's talk about it. Because one thing that I was really excited about when I did read the first biography is, and I didn't know this, that her father and grandfather were both clergymen.
Yes. Yeah. So she was born in the vicarage to a clergyman. And
she was born in 18...
No, she was born in 19... 2002, I think. I need to check that.
Yes.
Carol.
Okay.
Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's fine.
Early 1900s. She went to university in 1917, I think.
All
so,
right.
Yeah.
But she was
smart. Oh,
keep going. You keep, please. You know.
So she was born in Oxford, and very quickly they moved to the east of England, and her dad had a parish on the east coast there. And she was a very kind of intelligent child. She was homeschooled, and she very quickly began to develop a kind of gift for languages. So she got her first Greek New Testament at the age of 15 and started reading. She started reading that. Sorry. Yeah. She was born in
1893.
Thank you. You were right, Cheryl.
That's all right.
I should have checked my dates.
That's all right. No, up. It's so hard because for me, the dates are not as important as like, let's get to
yeah,
the story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So the life of the person. Yeah. So born. Yeah, that's right. Born at the end of the 19th century. And she developed this kind of love for languages and enjoyed the writings of G.K. Chesterton as a teenager, and you know, had a wonderful kind of vibrant personal Christian faith as a teenager that comes through beautifully in the letters.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I didn't know that even at that stage that she was passionate or, you know, had a faith, because you know, the one book I, the one book, I mean, it kind of made it sound that by the time she got to Cambridge, I'm sorry, Oxford, she was a little disillusioned.
So she had a bit of a crisis of faith at Oxford.
Which happens to so many students in college.
Yeah, but what was fascinating is that it wasn't really a crisis of unbelief in the sense that she still believed in God. She just had major questions really about the church and resolved those through correspondence with and conversation with her pastor, the vicar of the church she attended as a student. And by the end of her time at Oxford was probably more committed than she had been previously.
That's
often the case, isn't it? When we go through a trial, the impetus can be to sort of suppress doubt or encourage young people not to question, but actually it's healthy to bring those questions out, explore them deeply, and she definitely did that.
I read a book by George MacDonald years and years ago. I loved everything George MacDonald wrote, but he said, and I'm paraphrasing obviously, but he said, there's nothing that strengthens faith like an honest doubt. Because an honest doubt will be searched out. And it will end up strengthening your faith.
Yeah.
And so I, for me, as growing up in my brand of Christianity, it was kind of like, you know, don't question, don't question, yes. don't question. And I found that actually questions strengthened my faith. Yeah. They didn't dissolve it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I really like that.
And that would have been her a similar experience for her too. I mean, the fact that she was already reading the New Testament in Greek before she got to university gives you a sense of her level of engagement.
Well, I read that she could read and write by the time she was four.
Yeah.
And her father started teaching her Latin at 7 years old.
Yeah.
And that she learned French and German in grade school.
Yes, you know? And she studied Italian as well and medieval Italian later.
Because that will be very important in her story.
Absolutely. So definitely a real gift for languages and I think a kind of intellectual curiosity that was broad. So she read widely and after university she mixed with what was called the Bloomsbury set, who were, you know, in the 1920s London, people like Virginia Woolf and others who were embracing atheism, really the kind of emerging bright young things and intellectuals of that London scene. So she was definitely a Christian, but not a fundamentalist locked away. If that makes sense,
it does. Especially if you have read any biographies, you begin to see that. And of course, too, I think the Christian church expects Christian overtones or at least some kind of redemption story. And the Peter Wimsey mysteries were more working with the genre of mystery, perfecting almost that genre more than, there is redemption in a few of them. I just remembered the red herrings. But did she correspond with G.K. Chesterton, or she just admired him?
She just admired him, yeah.
Who was also an apologist.
Yes, and obviously a detective fiction writer.
Exactly.
With his Father Brown stories.
Which, of course, I love those too.
Yeah. So the detective fiction is really interesting. For me, I saw in that really early glimpses of her apologetic methodology, actually, because what you have is a sort of story, a narrative, and a set of events that have occurred, and people after the fact are trying to discover what happened, what's really the truth of what occurred. And in order to discover that, they have to sift through what you might call imposter narratives, so stories that are not true, that are proposed explanations that actually aren't true. And you come to a conclusion about the truth on the basis of evidence. And the detective, the job of the detective is to sort of pursue truth. So if you apply that to the historical Jesus and the idea of the resurrection of the Son of God, the sort of central historical reality of the Christian faith, you can see that Sayers was really interested in truth and evidence as a young person. And also this idea that the Christian faith at its heart is a story. It's a true story, but it is actually a story. And the incarnation is God, you know, coming as a person and living and dwelling among us, not just a set of ideas that we need to learn and master in
or moral structure.
Yeah.
Now she wrote, so she went from college and she started working again at the advertising agency.
Yes.
And that's when, you know, being a woman, so brilliant. Now we're talking about what, the 1920s?
Yeah.
So we've got, you know, World War One just, you know, yeah, ending, and you're dealing with kind of the rebuilding.
Trauma. Yeah.
Right. Of London, and she's beginning to, though I would think that being so brilliant, she would be frustrated in a job,
yeah,
of just simply advertising. Yeah. Does that come across in her letters?
So she left university and she really wanted kind of intellectually fulfilling work. So one of the big themes in her life as well is that some women, at least, do want to have, you know, pursue the intellectual life and not only operate in a domestic sphere, and that life should not be closed to them is a sort of theme. But at the same time, you know, her parents didn't have money, so she needed to support herself, and that's why she went into the advertising agency. But while she had a full-time job, she also wrote her novels. And it was only when, after Murder Must Advertise became so successful, that she was able to give up the job in the agency.
Now, you know, what I find interesting, though, is women really weren't at that time so much in the atmosphere of careers.
Yeah.
I mean, women having careers really happened during World War II more, with the deficit of men because they were going to war. And so women began to fill those positions. So for her to work in an advertisement agency and be so successful was really a novelty, wasn't it?
Yeah. So at that point, a woman could probably be a poor woman who had some education, might be able to be a governess. Obviously, women were servants in domestic service, or they were governesses, or they may have had kind of secretarial work. So it really was quite unusual to work in the sort of job she worked in, where she was actually coming up with slogans, and, you know, she wasn't just filing or typing. She was actually, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about how Josephine Butler.
Yeah.
Lived about the same time. I mean, she's older, obviously. But, you know, she opened those training schools for these young women because there weren't a lot of job opportunities open to women, and, you know, to get the young girls, giving them an alternative to prostitution.
Exactly.
To support. Yes. So, yeah. I mean, Dorothy Sayers with her, she was really opening the door to a lot of women to enter into college, into business.
Kind of trailblazer.
Yes,
in
she
a way.
Was. Yeah. Yes. I love that about her too. Yes.
Yeah.
So I know this, but I want to hear, like, Peter Wimsey, the detective in her novels. Tell us a little bit about him and who he was, because when you know the author, you begin to recognize who these characters are, a conglomeration of.
Yeah. So Peter Wimsey is Lord Peter Wimsey.
That's right. I forgot.
So he's a sort of aristocratic gentleman, which means he doesn't need to earn money. He doesn't have a job, but he has a gift for detection. And so the police often turn to him to help with unraveling crimes, murder crimes. And then you have the main character alongside him in Sayers' fiction is called Harriet Vane. And she's a sort of studious young woman who has, again, you know,
very plain.
plain but very looking, yes.
But attractive in a plain way.
Yes, exactly. Which is very close to Sayers' self-perception and perception of others, of Sayers, I think. Harriet Vane was a young woman who'd been to Oxford as well. So there are lots of kind of parallels with her. And there are different ideas about who Lord Peter Wimsey is based on. But as you say, a conglomerate of different ideals. But he kind of talks with this very over-the-top aristocratic accent and has a huge kind of amazing car and has fallen madly in love with Harriet Vane and is pursuing her romantically. And we'll leave what happens between them to...
You have to read the books.
Exactly.
It's all five.
Worn out.
All five
time.
Books. Yes. And I heard, too, that she was going to marry them off in like the second book, but she realized she wouldn't make enough money if she brought
she kept the books going. So, there are quite a number of them.
Yes. Yeah. So you have to go all the way to, is it Gaudy Night to find out what happens?
Yes, Gaudy Night. And then their actual marriage is called Busman's Holiday.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. You know, again, it's been quite a while
since reading the book.
And they're really the type of book that you take on an airplane.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were massive commercial success.
Right.
Dorothy L. Sayers and Agatha Christie were the main female writers of the golden age of detective fiction.
Right.
And obviously they're still in print and, you know, films have been made and all of that. So... the detective fiction was a creative outlet for her. She was interested in the kind of technical art of detective fiction as well. She chaired sort of London Society of Detective Fiction Writers, and she wrote academic articles as well about what detective fiction is and, you know, what its contribution to literature is. And then from a kind of Christian point of view, obviously there's this theme, this strand of... how do you come to discover the truth? How do you sift through imposter, untrue narratives about what happened? What does it mean to follow evidence? What does it mean to be a person for whom truth matters above all? I mean, that's really what Gaudy Night, the novel, is about.
I love this. It reminds me a little bit of Jane Warner Wallace, who we're both familiar with as an apologist, who did Cold Case Christianity.
Yes.
And it's the same idea. I was struck by that as you were speaking, like, oh, I never saw it as Cold Case Christianity,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
Going back. And I love that. So how long did you work at the advertising agency?
Oh, not for very long. So basically the main thing that happened at the advertising agency was that I think she worked there for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But while she was there, she had a relationship with... a writer called John Cornas, who was part of the Bloomsbury set and not a Christian, not a churchgoer even. And she fell madly in love with him. It was a great kind of meeting of minds. And he wanted, so it's like the swinging 20s, and he wanted to have a sexual relationship with her. And he said that he would never marry. On a sort of point of principle, because he kind of saw marriage as, you know, part of the, I guess, religious establishment or whatever. So Sayers had this huge dilemma. She loved him. She desperately wanted to marry him. She wanted to have children. And so they separated because she wouldn't sleep with him outside of marriage. And then he left and came to America and then wrote to her, I mean, months after they'd split up, not even a year.
My goodness.
Saying that he'd met somebody else and was getting married.
Oh, crushy.
And so the correspondence then continued, and he said that the whole thing had been a test from his point of view as to whether she would be willing to surrender her principles. Did she love him enough to surrender her principles? And she hadn't. Essentially, she loved God more.
Mm. Wow.
She fell into, obviously, quite a serious, I mean, maybe depression, but definitely devastation.
Right.
And started going out with a motorbike mechanic and didn't love him and did sleep with him and became pregnant. shockingly to her, obviously, and she kept the pregnancy a secret while she worked at the advertising agency. And so she just wore more and more kind of voluptuous clothes to hide the bump.
You're going to want to hear the second part of this because this is only the beginning. And so now you've got a little bit of the scandal. So we'll come back next week with part two of Dorothy Sayers with Dr. Amy Orr Ewing.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not-so-well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. If you think there is a woman worth knowing, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at WWK@cccm.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. Women Worth Knowing is a production of Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.